Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Anthropology, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Jacob Doherty, the host for this episode. Today we're talking to Alex Rosenblatt, a research lead at the Data and Society Research Institute in New York, and author of Uberland, How Algorithms Are Rewriting the Rules of Work, published in 2018 by the University of California Press. Uberland goes beyond the stories of share prices and corporate intrigue to examine what work looks like and what it means for Uber drivers. It does so by detailing the tensions between freedom and flexibility that Uber promises and the realities of invasive algorithmic management. It's a well-argued and really timely book. We're talking this the week that California passed a bill closing some of the loopholes that have given rise to the gig economy. So I'm delighted to have this chance to discuss Uberland today. Alex Rosenblatt, welcome to the show.
It's lovely to be here. Thank you, Jacob.
So before we delve into the book, could you tell us a bit about your background and how you came to this topic?
Sure. In early 2014, the gig economy was still the darling of the tech and labor beats. At the time, it was referred to as the sharing economy, which was a cultural phenomenon that effectively recast what it meant to work when that work was mediated by an app, whether it was through Airbnb or TaskRabbit or Uber. And I found a lot of that language and rhetoric about work as a form of altruism when it's mediated through an app to be a bit suspect. But at the same time, Uber seemed to promise a particular form of social justice. You see, many passengers, if they're people of color or if they're Black, have trouble hailing a ride on the side of the road because a taxi cab might pass them by and pick up the nearest white passenger. And here was a technology company out of Silicon Valley that was promising not only to provide transportation innovation, it had a policy of blind passenger acceptance, which meant that the driver didn't know much about the passenger at all before they had to accept the dispatch. That seemed to fulfill one of the longstanding tropes of Silicon Valley promissory notes that they can use technology to create innovation and progress at the same time. And so myself and my colleague, Luke Stark, started investigating what it was like to drive for Uber at the time. And of course, what we found is pretty far apart from, you know, what we started with.
And so this was around, Uber was launched in spring of 2010, and this was a historical moment in the aftermath of the financial crisis in the midst of the Great Recession. So could you say a bit about what, why that time period is so important for understanding the emergence of the sharing economy?
Sure. During the Great Recession, a lot of the institutions in which we hold trust started to break down, or trust in institutions started to deteriorate more. Cities were covered in blight as waves of foreclosure crises, you know, crossed the United States and elsewhere. And people were losing their jobs. They needed an alternative source of income. At that same moment, companies like Uber and other sharing economy companies promised that they could create entrepreneurship for the masses. And not only that, but they could provide a pathway to the middle class. Uber was recruiting drivers with advertisements that they could earn upwards of $90,000 a year. That was all quite well received, in part because tech gets a pass when it makes exaggerated claims. There's so much hope and promise and almost a sort of nationalism rooted in the way that Silicon Valley operates in the United States that it, whatever it promotes tends to get an initial acceptance of credibility. And so it was both, you know, a form of virtue signaling. We can provide jobs when people are in need of them. And it built on larger mythologies about tech as a natural force for progress. And so it really was meeting a need at the right time. And it delivered in many ways. It was really easy to start driving for Uber. There's a very low barrier to entry. And so it expanded quite rapidly, despite a lot of misgivings and conflicts about the legality of its business model.
And one of the interesting things you point out about this phenomenon was the way that the presence of technology in a kind of relatively established industry like driving taxis served to kind of gentrify or glamorize this work that was largely performed by immigrants and people of color in a lot of cities. But at the same time that it glamorized it, it kind of relegated its status as a real job and put it, produced it as something that was a side hustle or something on the side. So can you talk a bit about that paradox that you observe?
Sure. I remember early on in my days of interviewing drivers, some might say, oh, I work for a tech company. You know, it's very exciting. It's like saying you work for Google or another high status firm. And in many ways, what Uber did was tech wash the work of driving a taxi into something a bit more glamorous. It also promoted this work with avatars of millennials who were well-dressed and quite fashionable and were working for this internet company, you know, driving. In a way, it opened the door for lots of people who didn't have experience with commercial driving to start using their personal vehicles for work. So it capitalized in many ways on the idea of fashionable labor. At the same time, it was wrapped up in this rhetoric of sharing. When you were going to work, you weren't really trying to find, you know, a breadwinning job. You were doing it on the side. And moreover, you were just trying to assist your community of riders. And so it reformulated what it meant to go to work as a driver into something that was a social contribution, much like the vein of women's work, where women are expected to want to provide, you know, a home or to do a lot of social obligations because it's somehow innate to what they do, and therefore we shouldn't consider that a form of compensated labor. Uber did a little bit of that tech washing and share washing to the work of driving a cab, except it was mediated by a technology app.
Before we get too much into the findings that you present about the working conditions for drivers, can you tell us a bit about what it was like doing ethnographic fieldwork in Uberland, which is, amongst other things, a kind of disaggregated workplace where you don't get the kind of stable, immersive field sites that you might expect in another kind of ethnography of work?
Sure. So I did this ethnographic work across more than 25 cities in the United States and in Canada for 4 years. And in addition to visiting multiple sites of physical work, I spent every single day online in forums or Facebook groups or dedicated websites and chat boards and message boards where drivers had been gathering to share information or to request information, because one of the gaps in this work management is that a lot of drivers found that they couldn't get answers to questions they had when they were working for a company like Uber. There was a major information asymmetry, and frustrated by the lack of responsiveness they got from the app, you know, with my director inquiries to the equivalent of the email equivalent of call centers in the Philippines that would respond with template automated, oftentimes dribble, they turned to forums to ask questions. And so the initial starting point for a lot of drivers in interacting with other drivers across countless cities was from a point of frustration. You know, what do I do when the passenger vomits in my car? How do I claim, you know, a cleaning fee? How come I have to accept a dispatch that I don't want when I'm supposed to be an independent contractor? And so these forums actually became intense sites of driver gathering and aggregation, both of information and of a sort of frustration that became the baseline for how Uber drivers, you know, thought of Uber as an employer. And so my ethnographic work was really twofold. It was riding around in cars with strange men and sometimes women. And it was sitting in these online sites where I would say a minority of drivers actually gather, but they were still full of hundreds of thousands of drivers who were comparing notes to them all over the place. It might be a forum with 16,000 people in it, you know, that was initially started by someone in Indiana, for example, but drivers are comparing notes from all over the country and beyond. You know, a driver from Estonia might pitch in, or a driver from London might pitch in. And these forums actually started to mushroom. Sometimes people were cross-posting, but for the most part, there were developments of local groups, you know, in a given city, like a driver group for drivers in Atlanta. There were WhatsApp groups, and these were prompted by different types of conditions. One was a search for information to remedy a major information asymmetry about what the rules of working for Uber really were, because they weren't clear. And the second was as a form of ally building, because often when Uber started in a new city, it wasn't operating legally. And so in the initial phases of operating in a gray zone or an illegal zone, you know, Uber would ally with drivers, and drivers would warn each other in WhatsApp groups, for example, about where the local transportation police were likely to ticket them. And so the community that emerged was both from a form of, you know, fighting back against the persecution of police, and on the other hand, as a remedy to information gaps they had within their jobs.
Yeah, it's really interesting how much in the book we see that the function of management has either been devolved onto drivers and drivers' communities in forms like that, or outsourced to call centers, or in a lot of ways, it's management that's been automated. Driving itself hasn't been automated, but drivers are subject to what you call management by algorithm. So how does this kind of automated boss work, and what are some of the techniques of surveillance, control, and management that Uber uses to take that managerial function?
Sure. Well, we should start with the overriding assumption of what it was like to drive for Uber that was promoted by Uber and others through ads that said, you're your own boss, and when you drive for Uber, you're an entrepreneur.
Right.
And that was really appealing for a lot of people, particularly in the U.S., where entrepreneurship and business ownership is valorized, as opposed to, you know, a social welfare state. And when drivers started to work, a lot of them experienced an initial sense of independence. You didn't have a manager who was looking over your shoulder and perhaps, you know, yelling at you if you've had a negative experience with a manager. But in other ways, Uber was actually watching drivers much more carefully than a human supervisor could. It would monitor how quickly they were driving. It would send notes if a driver braked too harshly. It would use passenger evaluations to determine the employability of drivers. So in many ways, Uber just disaggregated the visibility and the forms of management. For example, if you've ever taken an Uber before or something like it, as a passenger, you'll notice that at the completion of a trip, you're often prompted to rate your driver on a scale of 1 to 5 stars. And a lot of passengers initially assumed, until drivers actively tried to re-educate them, that 4 out of 5 was a pretty good grade. You know, it wasn't the most amazing trip of your life, but you got from A to B, all your limbs are still attached. You know, it was fine. They might give a driver a 4. But Uber set quality parameters around rating. So a driver whose average rating fell below, let's say, 4.6 out of 5 stars, risked being deactivated, a technology word that means suspended or fired. And so the rating system ended up catalyzing a form of constant anxiety about being evaluated by passengers. And those passenger ratings, in turn, provided Uber with, you know, a measurement of which drivers were performing well and which ones should be threatened with deactivation. And so in lots of ways, although you're technically in a car, there's no manager there, you actually are being watched both digitally through the monitoring that can take place through the facilities and scaffolding of an app, and through passenger feedback that's then packaged into a sort of managerial tool to guide drivers on the ways they're expected to behave. Third, a lot of gig economy employers couldn't outright tell their workers how to behave because they classify them as independent contractors. And you can't really leverage too much control over how your workers behave on the job. Otherwise, it starts to look a lot more like a relationship between an employer and an employee. Instead, a driver might receive a notice that 5-star drivers behave in the following listicle of ways. So passengers give the best ratings to drivers who, for example, don't about other companies while they're on a trip, which is a bit ironic for a job that has entrepreneurship. And getting lead through an app. And so a lot of what I saw in my research with drivers over 4 years was that a form of management was emerging, and it was tied up both with actual algorithmic functions and policy decisions. So Uber, for example, would withhold key information a driver would need to make an informed decision. They would withhold the destination of a passenger and the value of the tip. So a driver had to work within certain performance constraints. If their ride acceptance rate went below 90%, or if their ride cancellation rate went below 5%, then they risk being deactivated. So they get a dispatch from an algorithmic dispatcher, and they can't see where the passenger wants to go or what the value of the trip is going to be. And if they accept it and find that the passenger actually only wants to go 2 blocks, you know, it may not have been worth their while to take the passenger those 2 blocks, or maybe the passenger wants to go to the airport, but the driver knows that the traffic on the way back is going to be like 3 hours long, and they'll just be sitting there with no passenger on the return trip. So they might want to make better decisions about which trips they accept, but they know that if they decide to, for example, cancel a non-lucrative trip, Uber will threaten to terminate them. And so drivers have to make all these decisions within constraints that in and of themselves aren't unreasonable. It makes sense that Uber would want all drivers to accept all trips and dispatches, so that passengers have a fairly standardized and positive experience. But it contradicts the idea that drivers are entrepreneurs who can make informed decisions in their own best interest, for which they would need both the information and the power to use their discretion in which job they accept. In other ways, Uber advertised that their model was really facilitated by technology, and that technology was neutral. It was just a series of pipes, you know, and so what Uber was doing was very, very hands-off, so it said. And it would say things like, oh, we only use algorithms to measure supply and demand. And then we set prices based on that measurement of the marketplace. But over the years of my research, I could very well see that the algorithmic neutrality concept was really a cover for pretty standard practices of price discrimination. So Uber might choose to, for example, set a higher price in one area, or even there were some instances where passengers might receive different price premiums for trips that were in the same search pricing zone. So a lot of what I was doing in my work was unmasking the concepts and myths behind the idea that technology is neutral, and looking at where new terms, new metaphors were coming to replace older mechanisms that we can easily recognize as management, but in a digital age.
And there's a lot of really compelling material in the book about what you call the debt to work pipeline and the kind of incentives to take on debt that drivers were subject to, about the kinds of commute and working conditions of drivers sort of extending to these incredibly long shifts, especially for drivers who were doing it as a full time, and as well about the different categories of driver between full time drivers and more recreational hobbyist drivers. But perhaps to wrap up the conversation, maybe could you reflect a bit on how what you've written about Uber reflects more widespread patterns in the changing nature of work in the United States and elsewhere? And the number of drivers for Uber is relatively small compared to the overall workforce. And a lot of the rhetoric about the novelty of this work is maybe self-serving techniques to avoid regulation. But you argue that even so, it signals important developments for the future of work.
It does. You know, it's amazing that Uber has become such a cultural force. You know, you can even see in today's news that the Assembly Bill 5, which in California would turn Uber drivers and other potentially misclassified workers, especially in the gig economy, into employees, has been a tipping point in longstanding issues of fissured workplace relationships and misclassification. You know, presidential candidates are coming out in support of it. And that really builds on two trends. One has to do with deteriorating conditions of labor, and the other is that Uber is low-hanging fruit or a tech lash, in which technology companies from Silicon Valley have long had almost a get-out-of-jail-free card for the types of expansions they've achieved and power they've accumulated. And there's a moment in which regulators are saying, hey, we want to, be more control of this, where consumers are also starting to distrust some of the tech that provides them with such valuable services, with accusations that, for example, Facebook is disrupting democracy. And so there's a larger sense that technology companies should be regulated. And Uber is sitting there as an actor who's had numerous press stories, right? Because Uber isn't just a company. It's a media phenomenon. It's a media beat. It turned technology reporters into labor reporters. And so although Uber only has about 4 million drivers worldwide and is not like the most significant employer in the U.S. by any stretch of the imagination, as a symbolic cultural force of technology and labor and how they interact, it's come to be much more influential than its numbers would suggest. And so watching how Uber is affected is actually a very good way of watching different coalitions build around what it means to work and what it means to find workplace protections. In many ways, what Uber is actually doing is, in its expansion, is evading regulations and then later lobbying for, you know, categorical exceptions to entrench their new position. When they start in a new city, they're usually not legal, but they also, of course, classify drivers as independent contractors. And then what I found in my research is that they actually manage them. They just manage them through automated and algorithmic controls. And so one question emerges, which is, can you use technology or an algorithmic boss to separate, you know, or weaken the relationship between employers and potential employees? If you're managed by algorithms, you know, can you effectively evade most labor law protections as an employer? So that's one thing to keep in mind. The second is that there's this other narrative that Uber uses in trying to pivot around various moments when it's sued for potentially misclassifying workers or for a whole host of other ills, rape, and sexual harassment to like tax fraud. And so it suggests that when drivers are at work, they're actually just consumers of Uber's algorithmic technology. And it makes this argument in a class action lawsuit where drivers are saying, look, you actually treat us like employees and, you know, we deserve a minimum wage and the other benefits of workplace protections for employees. And Uber's lawyers turn around and say, well, actually, drivers are just consumers of our technology, just like passengers are. And that would suggest that actually a lot of the ills that emerge in labor can be remedied through consumer protection law. So it's fundamentally trying to rewrite the rules that apply or to shift the categories under which we understand the act of working. And that itself is a really phenomenal example of how work can be shifted through these rhetorics of tech and through practices that enable management at the scale of algorithms. It also, to my mind, brings Uber drivers into a closer discussion of what it means to be a consumer of algorithmic technology or algorithmic management. Every time we use Facebook, for example, or Google, you know, we're experiencing curation of our information or our media sources done by algorithms. And algorithms have, of course, been narrated as neutral and objective and mathematical, when in fact they're a source of power. And that raises all sorts of questions, or rather reframes Uber drivers as a case study in which we can see how power takes shape and can be exploitative to its users, and suggests that it could be a mirror onto how consumers of everyday services in their lives, you know, can be taken advantage of or misled by algorithmic bosses.
Right, and consumers are also producing the data that's being mined and aggregated and sold that itself has an important value. So consumers are also performing certain kinds of work for these kind of algorithms and companies. So we've taken up a lot of your time.
Go after you. I was just going to mention that this narrative shift in work as a form of consumption isn't just an idea. You know, the Federal Trade Commission in the United States sued Uber for recruiting drivers with exaggerated earnings claims. And in doing so, the FTC doesn't have purview over workplace relations. It called drivers entrepreneurial consumers in order to intervene and to successfully find that, you know, drivers have been recruited with exaggerated earnings claims. And so there's a way in which I think other regulatory bodies are going to look at these shifting rhetorics, shifting narratives, and say, what's the framing we can use here to intervene and create, you know, greater accountability?
Right. So before we let you go, can you just say a little bit about what you're working on at the moment?
Well, at the moment, I'm still knee-deep in a lot of the interesting legal issues that emerge from Uber's many arguments about what defines it and why being a technology company is distinct from being a taxi company or even, you know, a traditional employer. For example, the bill that's likely to be passed in California, which would classify drivers as employees rather than as independent contractors, would have to be, you know, enforced. And so there's a number of policy issues that are raised. But there's also a fascinating back and forth between, you know, state interventions and the regulations and interventions of different regulatory bodies and how workplace protections apply. So in the U.S., for example, there's federal preemption. The federal government under the current administration has indicated that it would consider gig economy workers like Uber drivers to be independent contractors. So even if the state of California legislates that drivers and other potentially misclassified workers are employees, they can't form a union because that would preempt federal regulations and laws. And so they might get the minimum protections of labor as employees, such as a minimum wage, but they wouldn't necessarily be empowered to bargain collectively. And that has been a larger issue hanging over the gig economy and how we regulate work or think about the rules of work. Because if a whole host of independent contractors come together to collectively bargain over their pay, it's considered an antitrust violation. It's price fixing between, you know, hundreds of millions of small independent businesses. And so what started as a work issue has now escalated into a larger issue of corporate monopoly, and also whether antitrust law should be updated to try and address some of the ills of the gig economy. And so it always gets into this very complicated, you know, shift between if we define work as X or gig economy workers as Y, which laws apply, where do they apply, and how do they affect the dominoes of regulatory interventions that could take shape to try and find, you know, accountability and improve the working conditions of people across industries.
That sounds like an incredibly fascinating set of questions, and I'm looking forward to seeing your analysis of them as it comes through. So I want to thank you, Alex, for joining us on New Books in Anthropology. I've really enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a real pleasure.